Okay. Well, let's get started. So today is December 5th, 2013. I am Hillary Domish, chair of the Chemical Heritage Foundation, and with me is Jacqueline Boyton and Dr. Louis Hagedis. Did I say everything correctly?
Yeah, I call myself Louis.
Louis, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's always worrisome when I start out by mispronouncing something, but I always like to check. So, as I said, we start the oral histories by talking to you a little bit about where you were born and where you grew up. And I believe that you were both born and then raised in Budapest.
Almost. I was born in Budapest at the age 6 or so. We moved to a town called Szolnok. And I was actually raised there. More precisely, when I was born, my parents lived in what is now Slovakia, at part of Hungary. So after the war, when that part of Slovakia was, Hungary was assigned to Slovakia, we moved to back to the main part of Hungary, and the city's name is Szolnok. I grew up there. S-Z-O-L-N-O-K.
What kind of town is that? I mean, Budapest is at this time a big city with lots to offer. What kind of town is Szolnok?
At that time had about 40,000 inhabitants. It is 100 kilometers southeast of Budapest. It's on the banks of the second largest river of Hungary called Tisza, T-I-S-Z-A. So it's a nice place. It's a somewhat industrial town in the outskirts. And it was a pleasant place to grow up.
Did you have siblings as well?
I had a brother, 2 years younger. My father was a chemical engineer, so am I, and also my brother became a chemical engineer, so the whole family is chemical engineers.
Wow. What about your mom? Did she have any education?
She was a teacher. She was a teacher.
So I imagine then with a mother who was a teacher and a father who's a chemical engineer that education was something that was prioritized or,
yeah, absolutely,
or valued.
Absolutely. When my brother or I got a B about something, it was basically a family emergency. So it was taken very seriously, yes. Yeah. Rightfully so.
You said that after the war, when where you were living was kind of reassigned to Slovakia, or what became Slovakia, that you moved back to Budapest.
Szolnok.
Back to Szolnok. What do you have memories of what it was like during the war?
Yes, I do. I was born in 1941, and the war reached that part of Hungary in 44. So I remember as a small child bombings, you know, some bomb blasted out the window of our house, and I remember lots of glass flying around. And I vaguely remember, you know, all kinds of stories about fights going on while we were sitting in the basement. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the bombers was shot down, and I remember the tail pointing of birds in the fields. Apparently, it must have had made an emergency landing. So, you know, you remember bits and pieces of a small child. I remember the crossing the Danube from what has become Slovakia back to Hungary on a military pontoon bridge, you know, floating bridge. Our furniture was in a truck, you know. The truck had to cross the river. So, you know, one has memories of this sort. Yeah. Our windows were, I remember the windows were covered with black paper or cardboard or something, so they're, you know, so the bombers don't see the light. You know, you could turn on the lights, stuff like that. Typical war situation. Yeah.
Was your father fighting in the war, or was he?
No, he was too old for that. He was born in 1897. So by that time he was out of military age. Also, he was running this sugar refinery. Mm. You know, food production is necessary even in a war. So he fought in the First World War. He
oh, wow.
Fought in the Austro-Hungarian army. was a machine gunner. So he had his own experiences.
Did he tell you guys stories?
Oh, yes, lots of them, yeah. He fought on the Eastern Front first against the Russians.
Oh, wow.
And then he fought on the in the Italian front, in the Alps, in northern Italy. Mm. They captured him, and he was a military prisoner in Rome. He was, what, 19 years old or so, maybe 20. And he learned Italian. And then he escaped and somehow managed to get back to Hungary. And then he decided to become an engineer. He signed up at the chemical engineering department in the Technical University in Budapest. Finished there in 1923, I believe.
Wow.
And I went to the same school, and my brother went to the same school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A nice family tradition of education and engineering.
Yeah.
When we mentioned a couple of minutes ago how, you know, if you or your brother got a B in something in school, that it was kind of this crisis that, you know, kind of excellence in education was expected of you. Early on, what kind of things were you learning? I know that some of the schools in Hungary at this time were already kind of specialized on certain tracks. You could be put on a science track or kind of a humanities track fairly early on.
Yeah, that's very correct. We're talking about the high school. Basically, there were two, you had to make a decision, or your parents had to make a decision for you, I guess. There was one part, one track, which was called Human, and the other is Real, Human and Real. And the Human was mainly history, literature, and interestingly, biology. These were people who wanted to become teachers or doctors or lawyers. And the other, the Real, was more for mathematics, physics, chemistry, and those people became either science teachers or scientists or engineers. My father directed both of us to the human side. Mm. the argument was that you first of all need to have an education in the humanities without knowing, learning Latin and history and literature. You're not an educated person. So we both went through that part to learn Latin and all the rest. Over the years, you know, you benefit from this in various different ways, of course.
Did you enjoy that decision at the time? Did you enjoy learning Latin and history and literature?
Yes, I didn't enjoy it in the sense of preferring it. I enjoyed it in the sense of enjoying it as it is. I never thought of should I do it this way or that way. I think it was a decision of my father, and I trusted him completely, and he was right. So
now, even on the human track, do you still take any math or science?
Oh yes, of course, yes. But perhaps, obviously, somewhat less, given the finite number of hours in a week. We had to pick languages. Russian was mandatory at that time. But I don't remember much of it. It was not really practiced.
Was German commonplace?
And I had to choose the second language, which could have been French, English, or German. Mm. And I chose English. And after about 2 weeks of English, I concluded it is an unpronounceable language. So I switched over to German. I do maintain this view that it is extremely difficult to pronounce English. I'm flying an airplane around, you know, and as a pilot, you of course communicate in English. And it's kind of interesting, you know, when you call the flight service and they ask questions in an automated way to begin with, to put you in the right place. So the first question is always what state you are calling from. And I cannot say Pennsylvania. They tried Pennsylvania in so many different ways. The machine won't accept it. So anyway, that's a sidetrack here.
I've heard my husband is not a native English speaker, and he's very particular about things related to grammar. I think he's much more attuned to it because he learned it later. But I've read that because English, as opposed to some other languages, really is much more of a kind of mishmash of so many languages, whereas other languages kind of developed more on their own, that English does not have the same kind of grammatical rules that other languages do. Other languages have much, much stricter structure and kind of rules for the way people follow things or the way people pronounce things, and
which makes it makes English very suitable for quite sophisticated expression, because it's a contextual language. It is the context that the words which surround the word influence the meaning of that particular word. It's not necessarily so in many other languages, who decide to have different words for expressing different things. It's not that the English has a lesser number of words, but that structure which you pointed out makes English both very sophisticated and complicated, and also very easy to learn. How about that? Mm-hmm. And that's why it has become the language, lingua franca of the world, because you can learn it so easily. there are various levels of English, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when you made the switch after a couple of weeks from English to German, did you find the German?
Yeah, that's a phonetic language. It's vis-a-vis what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have an engineering mind, you know, you realize it is very structured, precise, you know, etc. One word has one meaning. Grammar can be worked out on a very large sheet of paper put on the wall. So you as you read something in German, you can pick out the proper place in the matrix on the wall as to what the ending of the words are.
Many more rules.
Yeah,
much more.
But
structure.
It's harder to learn it at the end. You know, of course, eventually, as you know, I ended up in Germany, mm-hmm. and you have to work hard on it. English somehow penetrates your brain because it is less of a grammatical burden.
Mm-hmm.
At least, broken English is not very grammatical.
No. I would say most spoken English, broken or not, is not very grammatical.
The funny thing is, I'm jumping ahead, but for a while in Berkeley, I took my notes in German because in German I felt it so precise. You can write. Of course, after a while, you switch to English.
That's interesting.
Can I ask really quickly what the name of the school was?
It's on. I have to write it down,
okay.
But I can spell it for you.
Okay.
Let's write now. V E R S H E G H I.
Okay.
It is a very good high school, one of the best in Hungary. At that time, it was very strict. And. I think the education we received was, in hindsight, fantastic. Very good. Yeah. Very good teachers. And it's very nice. It's in a beautiful park along the bank of the river. So it's kind of a very nice place.
That sounds it.
Yeah.
We have, as I mentioned during the Heritage Council meeting, we have kind of without having planned it, a growing number of oral history interviewees that were born and educated in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to kind of figure out if any of them went to the same high schools or anything like that.
Yeah, there are stories about it. As you know, all books have been written about this high school in Budapest. Several of the big name physicists went there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And read upon that, they had a particular teacher, I think Ratz was his name, R-A-C-Z, who basically motivated them. But that's a different subject.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your teachers were very, very good teachers. Did you have any that particularly motivated you or that were particularly important to you in some way?
Yeah, I was, at the beginning, I was very much impressed with, amazingly, geography. read a lot about, how the various parts of the world were discovered, and read stories about faraway places. So that was my first interest, which I remember. And then I became very interested in biology. We had a very good biology teacher. I thought it's fantastically interesting, biology. And then, of course, you know, I was always good in chemistry, physics, and I liked math as well. So you kind of gradually advance in or move forward in your interests.
And it was clear as you moved on that you wanted to move into kind of the sciences, the more technical.
Yeah, then for a while the idea was that I should be a doctor, an MD. So I shadowed one of our family doctor was a family friend as well, so he invited me to shadow him, etc., etc. So for a while it looked like I may end up at the medical school. But the real difficult thing in Hungary at that time was somehow to get into the technical university. That was considered to be, you know, if you want to be a doctor, yes, you know, there are several universities, they are very good, all the rest, but it, my perception was that at that time that it is not that tough to become a doctor. The real tough thing is to get into the technical university and become an engineer. That was considered to be very difficult. So you set out to do that, you know.
Was there an exam required to get into the technical university?
Yes, there was an entrance examination which I remember was extremely long and difficult, and you had to get a certain number of points. And at that time, you know, there was some classification of people into groups, you know, whether your parents belong to the intelligentsia, that means have a university degree, or whether they are workers or peasants or clerks or whatever. So depending on what class you have been assigned to, you needed different number of points. So if your father had a university degree, that means you were classified as member of the intelligentsia, then you had to have more points, so make it more difficult to get in, but we made it somehow.
Other than having to learn Russian in school and being classified as an intelligentsia and needing these extra points to get into the technical university,
these were the 50s, you know, 1950s.
Were there other things from this time period that you remember as kind of influences from the Soviet Union or the communist governments?
Yeah, I you know, all these things are well documented from that period. So I grew up at that time. Obviously, you were exposed to all of that, and saw lots of things, but that period has been so well documented and so well covered by historians, and it's still being researched. Interestingly, there are museums now which display materials from that period. So I don't know what can I add to it other than that I grew up in that time period, and just like anyone else at that time.
In addition to working hard in school and kind of making your way into the sciences and preparing for the exam, was there anything that occupied your time, any outside interests or hobbies?
Yes, I played a goalie in a soccer team, and that was just totally wonderful, you know, to play in the team. My father was, you know, technical director. I don't know if there is a title here. It's more than chief engineer, but basically he was the technical president of this sugar refinery. It was one of the largest in Hungary, and it was certainly the largest company in Szolnok. So it had a soccer team, and it had also a junior team. So as a high school student, I was a goalie in their junior team, and that was fantastic. But in the last year of high school, my father put some severe restrictions on playing soccer. His fear was that if you break your leg, you cannot prepare for the entrance examination, therefore you don't get into the university, mm-hmm. therefore you won't become an engineer, therefore you don't. So he derived this out all the way to the point of making sure that I basically stop playing soccer. Same thing happened to my brother. We were protected from failing the entrance examination, basically.
One wrong move in that soccer game.
Yeah, well, in hindsight, it was right, you know, it gave us more time. But anyway, I enjoyed soccer very much, very much.
And you said your brother played as well?
Yeah, he was a forward. He was fantastic, you know. He was really highly talented. I was just a reasonably good goalie, but he was phenomenal, yeah.
What was your brother's name? I don't think about that.
Michael. In English, or M I H A L Y in Hungarian. He died some years ago. He had cancer and died.
Okay.
He became a professor, university professor, and became well known in his own career. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Did he stay in Hungary?
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I tried to invite him out, you know, to come, but he somehow felt that he's just fine, thank you.
So after you took the entrance exam, mm-hmm. you needed more points, but you made it, you got your acceptance. What was the education like at the Technical University? Did you have to decide chemical engineering right away, or had you decided that?
You had to decide right away. You were admitted to chemical engineering. My memory is that there were about 100 people admitted to the incoming class. It was extremely hard. You know, at that time in the world, there was no free Saturday, say you guys are too young for remembering things like that, but we had to work 6 days a week, not five. So the university, of course, thundered on for 6 days, and you know, the way classes were, we were there the whole day, you know, from early morning until sometimes well into the evening. So the workload was extremely high. It was very structured. Nature of education at that time in Europe, in Hungary, was more along the German lines, you know. As you know, the old style German education focuses on knowledge. Mm. The American education has been focusing on understanding, figuring things out. And the combination is, of course, necessary in the world. And so when you pass through such an extremely rigorous, fact-based education, what we had, and then are exposed to the American way of, figuring things out and understanding things, the combination is very good, it's outstanding. That might be the explanation of why some people who were trained in that system and then came over to the US and were also either exposed to or trained in the American system, why they became so successful, because you kind of have gone through both of those dimensions. So it was very tough. I remember we had classes galore. The dormitory was on top of the Castle Hill in Budapest. It was an old historic building, and there were like 1,000 students in that humongous dormitory. I remember we there were large rooms with multiple two-level beds, double, like double-decker buses. And I remember there were six of us in the room when we started. There were two Mongolians. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of, we have never seen anyone in our lives who could learn Hungarian. And these two Mongolians learned Hungarian, which was kind of like a natural wonder, you know, how did they do it? Because language is so complicated, you know, and obviously they must have had some talent, you know. So we had to get up early in the morning, you know, and then race down 600 some steps.
Oh, wow.
From the castle here to catch the streetcar. And when 1,000 or so students all go at the same time to the same place with the same streetcar, right? You can imagine the scene. I had to hang on to the car, you know, etc. And it was very strict, you know, you had to attend. There was no way of not attending classes. It was enforced in a peculiar way. They randomly, you know, made a roll call. And if you missed a class three times, I believe, you were sentenced to failing that class, and you had to take a repeat examination. The way it worked is you could take an exam. If you failed it, you could take a repeat exam. Then with the permission of the dean, if he judged it appropriate, you may have taken a dean's exam, and if you missed that one, then you were out of that class. So you can imagine you missed the roll call. Of these three levels, you missed the first one. You had two more shots. So it was very interesting. You know, of course, it was literally impossible, you know, to attend 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 classes every day, etc. So occasionally disaster hit, and in the basement of the dormitory there was a medical office. It was a very nice doctor, and when some big disaster hit, like the electrical engineers, there were like 400 of them in their class, you know, when a roll call hit them, there were, you know, like 40, 50 electrical engineers standing in line for the doctor. Light them up, you know, along the wall, everyone open your mouth, they open their mouths, say ah, they all said ah. He went along with the flashlight and told the nurse, they all have throat infection. And then everyone got a piece of paper. So there were some humorous elements. But basically it was very tough, very tough. You had to memorize lots of things. It was more similar to what I observed in the medical school education of Monica, our younger daughter. You know, in medical school, you have to memorize a large number of things. You know, it's not enough to understand how your ear works. You have to also be able to fix it. So that was a tough element, you know, to memorize so many things. They fill your head with facts. It turned out to be useful in the long run, of course, you know. It's just useful to know. At that time there were 21 essential amino acids, to give you an example. You had to know the names of all of them with their chemical formula. Right? So you develop mnemonics in your brain to recite them. Or mineralogy, I remember we had to memorize the names and structures and compositions of hundreds of minerals, which sounds bizarre, but you at least have some idea of what crystals are. So it became as we, you know, most professions, as you go through year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it somehow peaks somewhere always, the difficulty peaks. And I think the third year was probably where it may have peaked. It was very tough at the in the first year, tougher in the second, very tough in the third. And then, you know, once you start to feel that you will make it and everything is fine.
In addition to all of the memorizing for so many of these classes, were there hands-on components or laboratory components?
Definitely. We had all kinds of labs. The first one was, in the first year, in fact, analytical lab, wet chemical analysis. And that's famous basement. That basement lab is still there, you know, when I go back to Budapest. And forgive me, can I?
No.